It's Tuned to Yesterday, featuring programs from the golden age of radio. I'm your host, Mark Livonier. There's science fiction in this hour later on from X-1 from 1956, but first it's 2000+, their second-to-last broadcast in the series from the 26th of December 1951, called The Temple of the Pharaohs.
2000+, science fiction adventures in the world of tomorrow. 2000+ presents The Temples of the Pharaohs.
Wilson aboard Spaceship ES calling Earth. Spaceship ES calling Earth. This is There it is, Sebastian. Sonar beam indicating contact with frequency gamma 4. You can start the message.
Right, Wilson. Spaceship EOS, rocket class C. Robert Wilson in command. Professor Sebastian reporting to Bureau of Astral Research and Statistics. Our geological and atmospheric findings will be ready on tape recordings at time of arrival. Anthropological findings, as usual. That is all.
Anthropological findings, as usual. Well, love that.
Committee? It's too bad about them. We can't find intelligent life where there isn't any.
No, only signs of the once was life on almost every one of those cold, dead worlds.
What's that?
Robert, directional alarm.
Directional?
We'll swing you off our course.
Well, then, Andy, you're sitting right there at the controls, corrected.
What do you think I'm trying to do? That's no good.
What do you mean? What's no good?
The controls. The dials and directional rockets are working fine. Something's wrong outside. We're not traveling in free space.
That's impossible.
Is it? Listen to that vibration. The ship's caught in some kind of whirlpool, a space whirlpool.
The light. What happened to the light?
Wilson, where are you?
I can't see you.
Are you here, Sebastian? Say something. I can't hear you. I'm off, Sebastian. Off.
Calling Earth. Spaceship ES calling Earth. ES to Earth.
Wilson.
Yes, Sebastian. You all right?
I think so. I'm weak and my head is spinning, but what happened, Wilson? The lights, the vibration.
All I know is we blacked out, both of us.
Yeah, but what was it? What caused it?
I don't know. Whatever it was, we passed through it safely and the ship's unharmed. There's only one trouble, Professor.
Trouble?
I can't contact Earth. I've been trying for hours. Nothing.
Are you sure you're beaming the signal in the right direction? You said our controls weren't working.
They're working perfectly now. I'll check out bearings again. Turn on the sigma wave telescope.
Right.
All right. Now, let's see. There's the Great Horn Galaxy that we just left. Beyond that, at 20 degrees, the 12 gaseous galaxies, the star of the outer circle. And down below, the bright median formation, our own solar system, the North Star.
Wait a minute. What is it?
But it just can't be.
Oh, for heaven's sake, Wilson, what
the sky? The sky is wrong, Sebastian.
You mad?
Am I? Well, all right, you tell me. Go on, look for yourself. Where's Mater's comet?
Mater's comet? Well, it's right there, but... No, it's gone. It's not there.
You're darn right, it's not there. And there are other things wrong with that sky. The constellations are all twisted up. Halley's Comet is back where it must have been a few thousand years ago. Sebastian, I've got it. That sky. That sky is the sky of about 5,000 years ago.
But how can that be? What does it mean?
It means we've been knocked out of our own time orbit. We've been hurled 5,000 years back into the past.
The whirlpool thrust us away.
The whirlpool. It was the Universal Space-Time Conversion Center where all the orbits of space and time converged. Like the spokes of a wheel. Only we came out on the wrong spoke. When we get back to Earth, Sebastian, if my calculations are correct, we will be in Egypt in the year
3000 B.C.
That's it, Sebastian. Robot landing alarm. Strap yourself in, say your prayers. We're going to crash land in less than 30 seconds.
Come to you.
you as messengers of the sun god Ra and Osiris, god of fields and of the rivers. Our ways are the ways of the gods, and we bring you miracles of life and life after death.
Ryosin, Ryosin, holy Fa.
The first miracle will now be passed, O Pharaoh.
Listen, O Pharaoh, and our words will be understood by you, and yours by us. Speak to us, O Pharaoh.
And Kolifar asks that you tell us from whence your great sky bird comes.
The gods have sent us, Kolifar. Before we speak again, strike the chains from our wrists that our thoughts may be of peace and understanding.
So be it. Vizier, Toucan, strike the bonds. Remove the bonds from the wrists of the strangers. They have spoken in a strange tongue that is not ours, nor yet the tongue of Babylonia and Assyria, and yet the words have meaning.
Even as your words, O Pharaoh, have meaning for us.
Why have you come within our gates, strangers?
We know not why, O Pharaoh. The will of the god Ra is strange and unpredictable. Our course was charted without our knowledge. The great skybird that brought us here lies upon the sands of Giza, tired from the journey. We must return at once to care for it.
Let food and water be brought to the skybird that it may be refreshed. Prepare baths of oil and precious spices and fresh shifts of linen for the strangers. I, Kolifar, Pharaoh of all Egypt, bid you welcome to the land of the Nile and invite you to rest before you return to the great bird. Toucan.
Toucan awaits the royal command.
Let the high priest prepare a feast for the sun god Ra and his messengers. Lead them to their chambers now, that they may bathe and rest. I, Kolifar, have spoken.
Destroyed by those who will not let her rest in peace. And now, this...
Toucan!
Don't this your tukal, O king? My tongue is rooted. My throat distressed.
The brass is sound. What new misfortune to come? Speak to me, vizier, or I will have that tongue torn from its roots and have thee rendered limb from limb. Speak! What plague has descended now upon the house of Pharaoh? The little prince, so small, so heavy.
My son, no.
The guards murdered. Even as he lay in his golden cradle, some madman intent on evil snatched him from his linen sheets. The little prince has been abducted.
My soldiers and slaves to search the bulrushes and the riverbeds and fields and houses. My son must be found, alive or dead. Bring me back the flesh of my flesh, the prince who is the last of the line of Khalifah. I, Khalifah, king of Egypt, issue this warning. For those who have robbed the grave of the dead queen, my mother, those who have robbed the cradle of my son, the living prince, the penalty is death without burial, death for all eternity. I have spoken.
See how the lily flows upon the bosom of the Nile. The body of my child may be feeding them.
You are messengers of the gods. You have said so. You have magic far beyond the powers of the court magicians. The instrument that makes your speech and ours intelligible to each other. The great bird that carries you through the heavens. These are miracles beyond the dreams of even a Pharaoh. You must use this magic.
Even to the gods, O Pharaoh, there are some things that are not possible. Our magic cannot find your son.
He is so little, stranger. With great dark eyes and trust in his heart.
Egypt is vast, Your Majesty. There is nothing we can do to help you, even though our hearts too bleed for the little prince.
Perhaps.
Yes, perhaps. We may fail, King Khalifah. We may rouse false hopes and leave your spirit even more troubled than it is now, but there is a machine which rests in our flying bird, our spaceship.
Machine was
the audio wave amplifier. Suppose we try it, Sebastian. It's just a chance.
Audio wave detector.
Your words fall on ears that do not comprehend.
They cannot, oh, sir, for this is magic that reaches forward into time, forward into the vast infinity of the future. But the machine whereof I speak.
Then it must be brought here at once. Listen to me, strangers, messenger of Ra and Osiris. Thrice the house of Khalifah has been struck. The grave of the queen, my mother, has been defiled by grave robbers. I have but lately eluded death from a dagger in the dark. And now, my son, my little prince, if you find the prince, I will make the gods offerings of electrum and gold, jewels and linen beyond compare. I will erect a temple.
Yes, yes, Pharaoh, but we must not let the shadow of the sundial pass another segment. The machine must be brought here at once.
Cradle in which the little prince slept.
And there beyond the cedar doors where the guards were slain, I too conned his ear.
But the prince is gone now. Why do you tarry here while his abductors take him beyond our reach?
It is here, O Pharaoh, with this magic device that the miracle must be performed. For it is in this very chamber that we shall hear the words of the conspirators.
There is no sound here save the drone of your
amplifier.
Amplifier?
Have you ever stood upon the banks of the River Nile, O Pharaoh, and tossed a pebble into the water?
Yes, yes, many times.
You've seen the waves which it produces move out in ever-widening circles. The waves become fainter and fainter until at last the naked eye cannot see them.
Yes, yes.
But the motion is still there. The invisible ripples keep spreading through the water, even until the great river flows into the sea.
I do not understand. How shall this recall my son?
The spoken word, O Pharaoh, like the pebble in the water, produces waves in the air which spread in ever-widening circles and finally become too weak to be heard by the naked ear. But this magic device, Khalifah, can give new strength to the waves and make them audible. Listen.
is impossible. Who would desecrate the tomb of the dead?
Whoever would dare steal the child of the great Pharaoh.
Any man who defiles a sacred tomb is struck dead.
Nevertheless, if you want to find your son, that is where we must go.
The wise men from the skies do not know, Excellency, that there is no access to the tomb of Barkisha. That its entrance has been sealed secretly for all eternity so that the living may not disturb the dead.
I will find an opening, Caulifar. The miracles of the great bird are not exhausted. Send the deaf-mute Ankhimar with me to show me the tomb, and I will force it to yield its secret.
But you cannot!
Let it be so! And may the god Ra smile upon you.
What are you up to, Wilson? How are you going to get through a mountain of limestone?
You'll see, my lad, because you're coming with me.
Outside of his tomb looking for an entrance. There isn't any.
I'll keep trying till I've covered every inch with this radar projector.
Radar projector? What's it supposed to do? Drill holes in solid rock?
You know how a doctor taps your chest to see where it's hollow and where it's not?
Percussion on a mountain?
That's exactly what I'm doing. Only instead of tapping with my fingers to find the hollow cave beyond the entrance, I'm hitting the surface of this rock with a radar beam. If I come to a hollow spot, well, I'll be able... Sebastian, listen.
Sounds different.
It is different. This is it, Sebastian. This boulder is the gateway to the tomb of Barkisha. Signal the deaf mute to come over. We'll need his slaves to move it. And then I'm going in.
You mean we're going in?
One of us has to stay out here to organize a rescue party just in case anything happens. I'll keep in touch with you on the shortwave.
Here comes the deputy Ankhimar. Better show him what you want.
Here, you. All of you. Like this. Yes, that's the idea. Ready, Sebastian? One. Two. Now she's giving. We found the entrance to the tomb. Again. One, two, three.
No, I dare not.
Know the penalty for treason. Drink
from that goblet, Vizier, my friend, my noble counselor.
No, no, I cannot. Do not kill me. Do not kill me. I must
take him away. Remove him from my sight. And when he is dead, let no stone mark the place where his worthless soul is buried.
Great heavens, Sebastian, I'm floored. How did you do it?
Do what?
Spot that vizier as the poison. How did you know there was poison in the goblet?
I saw the vizier put something in it.
Yes, but how did you know it was poison?
I'm an archaeologist, Wilson, a student of history. Don't you see? I knew there was a pharaoh called Kolifar. I knew an attempt was made to poison him, and the attempt failed. So I kept my eyes open and spotted the vizier. I read all about it in a book. Years from now.
Please do not leave us. Rest with us longer.
Must you leave us, sons of Osiris? You have rendered us much service with your feats of magic. These jewels and gold are but a small token of our gratitude.
We must leave, Kolifar. It is written in the stars. The gods grow impatient for our return.
Already the wheels that turn our spaceship are impatient for flight. The bird is eager to rise.
We find your great bird strange and exciting. What is the picture painted in bold colors upon the side?
It is a symbol, Pharaoh. It is called the Sphinx.
Sphinx? Sphinx? That is an Egyptian word. I must examine the picture more closely. Strange. Most strange. That bird comes to the Garden of the Gods and rests upon the sands of Giza. And yet, look upon the picture you call the Sphinx. The body is that of a crouching lion, but the head...
The head, my lord, is your head. The features, the face... It's your face.
It is an omen from the gods. I, Kolifar, decree that upon this very spot in Giza, which guards the river Nile, there shall be carved from this mountain a statue complete in every detail, an exact copy of the picture upon the stranger's great bird. The head shall be my head, the eyes brooding and distant, and the body that of a crouching lion. The statue shall be called the Sphinx.
Next week, another exciting adventure from the world of tomorrow. Another unusual story of science fiction on 2000 Plus.
2000 Plus on Tuned To Yesterday from December 26, 1951, from the Mutual Broadcasting System. The show hit the airwaves only a month before NBC's landmark sci-fi series Dimension X hit the air, but the arrival of 2000 Plus on radio before made it the first science fiction show geared toward adults. We just heard the last surviving broadcast in the series. This is an hour of sci-fi on Tuned To Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Now time for X-1 with the story Project Trojan, an NBC broadcast from June 19, 1956.
Countdown for blastoff. X-5, 4, 3, 2, X-1, fire. From the far horizons of the unknown come transcribed tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future, adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on a thousand maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, presents
X. minus one.
Most of the greatest contributions and biggest messes in history have been made by two kinds of brains, the devious and the literal. We quote from the monthly column written for Galaxy by its editor, H.L. Gold. For our story tonight has been inspired by one of his recent columns, discussing the exceedingly thin line that sometimes lies between science fiction and science fact, and of the strange use that both Allied and German intelligence made of science fiction during the recent World War II. Our report, of course, is entirely fictional, but similar schemes are known to have been attempted by both sides. And now, here is Project Trojan.
The idea of Project Trojan was originally conceived in February of 1943. The Intelligence Plans Commission, an adjunct to Joint Army and Naval Intelligence, was under the command of Colonel Sir Harold Bostwick. The first antecedent of Project Trojan occurred on an afternoon in February. Corporal Arthur Muggeridge was serving tea to Lieutenant Maurice Withering and Captain Amos Mackenzie.
There you are, sir. That's real butter on the bread. I won 5 pounds of it from one of those Yank mess sergeants over at the Crown and Lance.
Oh, butter, eh?
Aye, sir.
Mackenzie.
Hmm?
Well, confounded man, you might show some interest. Here Muggeridge tangles with the 8th Air Force to improve your tea, and you sit there reading. What the devil is so engrossing?
No, never mind.
If it's me you're worrying about, you needn't, sir. I was cleared for most confidential and top secret before I set foot in the pantry.
What is it, Mackenzie?
Well, I was reading about a fascinating notion. It's a machine, you see, dreadfully ingenious. It's a method of setting up a reverse polarization field about a given metallic surface, say, the plates on a submarine or a tank. Makes them 5 times as strong. A little more cream, Muggeridge.
It's powdered milk, sir.
Hush, leave me to my illusions.
Well, Mackenzie, how can you be so calm? Don't you realize what this means? Tanks 5 times as strong? Is it in production? I mean, when do the first models go into combat? It's certainly been a well-kept secret.
I wouldn't say that. There's about 50,000 people who know all about it here in England. And, of course, a great many more in America.
Oh, that's impossible.
But I doubt if it will ever be used in combat.
But you're stark raving crackers. A secret like... Where did you find this? Now, let me see that.
There you are.
Incredible science fiction.
It's an American magazine.
You mean this is a story? One of those Jules Verne things? You've been pulling my leg.
I
mean, after all... Well, Captain Mackenzie, I hardly think that... Well...
Now, don't get stuffy, man.
After all, do chaff me before the ranks.
I don't mind, sir.
But it did have you going, didn't it?
Well, it sounded plausible. I don't know a confounded thing about electrical fields.
Even if you did, it might take you in, huh? You see, the trick these science fiction lads do is to take something that's solid as a rock and then to push it just a wee bit forward till you simply can't tell where the science ends and the fiction begins.
Still, I wish you'd exercise your ingenuity in deceiving Jerry rather than me.
Good Lord. That's a fine idea.
What is?
If an intelligent, brilliant officer and gentleman like yourself might be taken in by a wild tale like this, whom else's leg might we pull? Huh? Muggeridge, another bread and butter sandwich, if you please, and take one yourself.
Lieutenant Withering and Captain Mackenzie worked out preliminary plans for Project Trojan and presented them at an appropriate time to Colonel Sir Harold Bostwick.
Well, sir, sit down, Withering, Mackenzie.
Oh, thank you, sir.
We had breakfast. I understand Corporal Muggeridge has been playing darts with the Yanks again. There are fresh eggs for breakfast.
We've had breakfast, sir.
Oh, well, then.
We have a plan, sir.
Capital.
You remember, sir, our intelligence reports indicated a concentration of German research scientists working near Hanau.
Certainly, I recall. They've got the whole lot of them inside a mountain. We tried bombing. I doubt if they even noticed.
They're supplying the basic research for the German guided missile program.
Yes, we know that. The reaction motor for the V-1s came out of the Hanau lab. Oh, Muggeridge...
You see, sir... If a considerable number of those research scientists were diverted to another project, the rocket program would be crippled.
Yes, well, of course it would. What are you going to do? Advertise in the Times and offer them high wages?
Aye, sir.
Oh, Muggeridge, this coffee.
No, sir.
Next time you go to the Crown and Lance, keep coffee in mind, will you?
Aye, sir. Only the Yanks are getting fair dives at darts. It was touch and go with the eggs.
Oh, we can only expect you to do your best.
I'll try, sir.
Well, now, come to the point, gentlemen.
Suppose the Germans got hold of one of our top new development weapons. Something so completely overwhelming that they'd have to pull almost every man off rockets to work on it.
Now, look here, Mackenzie. Those Jerry scientists are not exactly playing about with small boys' chemistry sets. They're a cut above our own chaps in several fields. What makes you think you could plant something on them?
Science fiction, sir.
I beg your pardon?
Do you see this magazine?
Yes. Incredible science fiction. What's that chasing that girl there?
That's a Martian, sir. You can tell by his tentacles.
Mackenzie, are you stringing this along preliminary to applying for compassionate leave on the grounds that you're overworked?
No, sir. It's a good plan. We invent a weapon. A weapon that might exist, but doesn't. And we leave it lying about where the Germans can snaffle it.
And then they take most of the scientist fellows off the rocket program to work on our weapon.
And that's the most preposterous nonsense I've ever heard.
But, sir...
I don't want to hear anything more about it.
Yes, sir. I suppose she was right.
Who was right?
This Wren. I met her going up to London. Rather proper little type till you got to know her. But then she's rather a firebrand.
Captain Mackenzie, please spare us the sordid details of your off-duty peculations.
Sorry, sir. You see, she's the secretary to Admiral Sir Alan Grummins. They're talking of dropping this unit. They feel that other intelligence groups are quite competent to handle the routine, unimaginative work that we've been doing.
Oh, I see.
Of course, they'd reassign personnel.
Mm-hmm. Would you say this... This science fiction scheme of yours was imaginative?
Oh, it's practically visionary.
Well, suppose you do some preliminary work.
Thank you, sir.
Routine, eh? Unimaginative, eh?
Bah!
On the 14th of February, preliminary work was begun on Project Trojan. At first, Lieutenant Withering and Captain Mackenzie worked alone, researching the source material of the project.
Slamming the firing keys, brick blasted down on the Krull warship. Bright beams of crisp destruction lanced out from the giant dreadnought and licked along the plates of Brick's one-man scout.
Nothing in that one.
What have you got?
It's a story about two robots who fall in love.
What's the name of that Johnny who came closest?
Herman. Jad Herman.
He got half a dozen ideas that are close. Where do you suppose he is?
Somewhere in the States, I suppose.
That's no use, then.
Why? Look, man, perhaps we can put a query through Central Chafe Intelligence. The Yanks ought to be able to dig up this Herman chap for us.
No. It's worth a try.
It took 7 days for a report to reach IPC that one Jacob David Herman, a private first class in the American Air Force, was based on a field north of Cheltenham in the Gloucestershire area. Lieutenant Withering and Captain Mackenzie requisitioned transport and visited Herman at his place of duty.
You don't mind if I go ahead with my job, do you? I gotta have this place ready for inspection by 1300.
Go right ahead.
Hand me the cleaning powder, will you, please?
Oh, yes.
What do they put in porcelain in England? You break your arm trying to get it clean.
Private Herman, you are Jad Herman? Writer?
Yeah, that's a pen name, Jad. I use it for SF stuff. I used to write for the Confessions under the name of Cynthia Herman. I remember one article. I was saved by the YWCA from a life of shame.
We're interested in your science fiction articles at the moment.
Oh, yeah? Well, I knew we had some sci-fi fans in England.
But we're not exactly a sci-fi fans. We're from... anybody else here?
Well, look for yourself. There's no hiding place down here.
We're from Intelligence Plans Commission.
Uh-huh.
We need your assistance, sir, Mr. Herman.
No kidding.
We have a project that calls for your particular talents.
You got a latrine needs cleaning?
We're quite serious, Mr. Herman. Will you kindly pack your things and be ready to come with us within 1 hour?
Oh, I'm sorry, gentlemen. I couldn't possibly leave until after inspection. I've got too much of myself invested in this latrine. But after that, I'm at your service.
Project Private First Class Jacob D. Herman, 3296-2126, was transferred on special detached duty to Project Trojan and after briefing was set to work on basic plans.
Now, look, Mac, here's the way I see it. If you want to con a scientist, you got to be pretty straight all the way. You can't get away with more than one phony step in the process.
Precisely.
Now, here's the way I see it. It's a focusing beam weapon. The electronics on that are square. I used it in a story about 2 years ago. Feinschreiber at MIT and Temple and Westover at the Bell Telephone Laboratories worked out the basic field formulas.
Oh, you mean it's real?
Well, up to a point. Everything's on the level till you get to the catalytic action on the grid. Now, that just won't work. It's a basic problem in physics, and it, well, makes the whole thing impossible.
But don't the Germans know that?
Oh, sure, sure. You see, you make up plans for the weapon, call it a death ray. You let the Germans steal everything but the catalyst formula. They'll think we've got it licked, and they'll break their necks trying to duplicate it before we put the weapon in production.
I see. But we can't call it a death ray.
Well, how about projector electronic grid deflecting type 3?
That has a brawl ring to it, my lad.
I've got the basic idea of the thing, but you'll have to get some of your science boys to work it out.
Oh, we'll put a requisition into the Manpower Commission in the morning.
Doctors Montague, Felder, Harrison, Sisonby, and Pilsudski were assigned to Project Trojan, and under the direction of Private First Class Jacobs, complete specifications and plans for projector electronic grid deflecting type 3 were drawn up. Project Trojan was ready for phase 2.
Have we got everything? Blueprints?
Check.
Specifications?
Check.
Machine tool inventories?
Check.
Letter rejecting the plans from the War Office?
Check.
Endorsement from Supreme Headquarters rejecting plans?
Check.
Note from 10 Downing Street overriding rejections, handwritten postscript, build the confounded thing, WC.
Check. Don't you think that's going a little too far, the rejections?
Not at all. That's the master touch. A rejection of an idea by the War Office makes it appear most genuine. All right. Private Herman, if this thing were real, if it could be built, what would it do?
Oh, don't ask. You could blow a hole in a mountain 10 miles away. Well, you could knock down a whole wing of bombers without even aiming.
Oh, dear. Lucky it won't work.
I should say so. Oh, well, now to get this lovely thing into Jerry's hands.
Phase 3 of Project Trojan was commenced on the 15th of March, 1943. Central Counterintelligence Agency had discovered the infiltration of a German agent, a Belfast Irishman named Gogarty, into the blueprint division of Clark and Porchester, a printing firm doing some subcontract work for the Air Ministry. Gogarty, the German agent, presumably microfilmed the plans because shortly thereafter he received word that his sister, living in the Irish Free State, was to be married to a bus conductor. British agents attending the wedding disguised as farm labourers lost track of Gogarty for several hours due to circumstances beyond their control.
Then we have no way of knowing whether Gogarty delivered her Project Trojan plans.
Well, sir, there was a submarine sighted a day before off the coast. It's likely he made contact.
Well, keep me informed. That's all we need now, another disaster.
Did something else go wrong?
You're jolly well right. Muggeridge has been playing darts with the Yanks again.
Oh? What have we got this time? Butter or beefsteak?
Nothing. The blight has lost my whole month's whiskey ration.
Now, the cover operation supporting Project Trojan was undertaken. A battalion of the Royal Engineers was detailed to practice at secret installations with wooden mock-ups of the projector. A lance corporal in this detachment, a volunteer afterwards awarded the George Medal, was court-martialed and sentenced to 7 years' hard labor for revealing information about the project while drunk on a 3-day leave to Tynecastle. This particular aspect of Project Trojan has been in the news recently, inasmuch as several backbench Labour members of Parliament have asked questions in the House, as it came out that the corporal served the full 7 years and wasn't released until 1951. The Home Secretary explained that this was an unfortunate oversight, and there were jeers from the opposition, with Mr. Anoyden Bevan taking the occasion to call for the resignation of the government. At the time, March and April 1943, the Intelligence Plans Commission awaited reports from British operatives.
Sir, there's been a shift in assignment at the research laboratories at Hanau. Professor Schlickmann and Drs. Hirsch, von Sulau, and Grischmann have been transferred from rocket research to another project.
Trojan?
We must assume so.
But that's only four men.
But they're the top experts in electronics, chemistry, and metallurgy. If they're really working on Trojan, we've set the German rocket program back a year, while their scientists go yelping off after a red herring.
Well, let's hope so. Bring me any further reports as soon as received.
British intelligence reports, filtering back through occupied Norway and neutral Sweden, continued to indicate the success of Project Croton. Four more top scientists were known to be transferred from the rocket research base at Peenemünde to the Hanau laboratories. Definite knowledge was obtained that the new assignment was a startling new weapon, agreeing in detail with Project Croton.
What a sally, McKinsey. What a stunt.
Yes, sir.
We shall have to have a little party to celebrate. We'll have that Herman chap in for a drink. I'm sending Muggeridge off to play darts with some of the Free French over at Germain Manor. He ought to be back soon with the champagne. Pour all round. Private Herman?
Thank you.
All right now, to the projector, electronic grid deflecting type 3. The biggest fraud since the South Sea bubble.
Colonel Bostwick.
Oh, Withering, take a glass. We're just drinking to Trojan.
Well, I think I'd rather not, sir.
What do you mean?
There's a dispatch from Germany.
What about it?
A section of the mountain overlooking Hanau has disappeared.
What?
It's true. It was on the reconnaissance maps yesterday, and it was gone this morning. A 10-mile slice of mountain.
That's impossible.
No, it isn't. It works. Trojan works.
But it can't. There's no catalyst. It's impossible. All our scientists said so.
Well, I guess they were wrong. It works.
They must have found the catalyst.
I suppose we should have foreseen that. All those scientists working on it.
They must have built the model and tried it out.
It won't take them more than 3 months to put it into production.
Well, there goes the war.
Muggeridge.
Aye, sir.
Fill the glasses up again.
Intelligence Plans Commission now waited for additional dispatches concerning the reaction to Project Trojan in Germany. It was decided as a matter of policy to confine knowledge of these latest developments to the personnel of the project.
Anything new, Mackenzie?
No, sir, except that aerial reconnaissance confirms the damage to the mountain at Hanau. It's not quite as extensive as the first dispatch, but it is a bit of a hole.
Oh, what do they think caused it?
The Air Ministry seems to feel that an ammunition dump must have blown up.
Couldn't that be it?
I'm afraid not, sir. We have an intelligence report about several captured British and American tanks being brought to Hanau for testing. They were spotted the next day, completely destroyed.
Trojan?
Trojan. There's been an alert at factories producing parts for V-1 and V-2 rockets to prepare for retooling.
They're going to make the projector?
It would seem so, sir.
Well, I suppose I'd better go up to London tomorrow and make a clean breast of it.
I'm afraid so, sir.
Well, that's the end. Seems rather unsporting, doesn't it? Just handing the war over to them. I hate to think what the War Office will say. Not to mention the Prime Minister.
Project Trojan was nearing its closing phase. At precisely 0600 the next morning, Colonel Sir Harold Bostwick ordered his staff car and, taking a thermos of tea, proceeded to leave his office. Just before the staff car got underway, Lieutenant Withering appeared with another dispatch, accompanied by Captain Mackenzie and Private Herman.
Colonel Bostwick, sir. Wait.
So what is it, Withering?
Another dispatch.
No, don't please. It's bad enough.
There's been another disaster at Hanau.
They knocked another mountain with our little present to them?
No, sir. They've knocked themselves out.
What?
The laboratory under the mountain. It's exploded.
It has?
Went up like a Roman candle. We've got pictures. There was a flight of mosquito bombers over at the time.
What happened?
The projector. It backfired.
How do you know?
It had to. That's why the catalyst is impossible. You see, the metal fatigue on the grid is a function of...
Never mind. Are you sure?
Yes, sir. We have a reliable agent's report. The Germans are completely confused. They were operating the projector under a top-secret designation. Nobody knew any of the details except the dozen scientists working on it. And they were inside the laboratory when it blew. Our man was in the rescue squad. There isn't a thing left, sir. Plans, models, or scientists.
Sir, do you realize that Project Trojan was a success? We've diverted a dozen top scientists from the rocket program permanently. Well, do you think we'll be decorated?
Lieutenant Withering, inasmuch as we came particularly close to handing the whole war to the Germans on a silver platter, I suggest we forget Project Trojan.
Oh, yes. Yes, I see. Of course.
You're very canny, sir.
I think we had all better return to precisely what we were doing before the whole nasty mess started.
The final phase of Project Trojan was completed on the 22nd of March, 1943. The file, through some inadvertent error, was lost before the Intelligence Plans Commission had a chance to report to the War Office. All personnel returned to their previous assignment.
All right, no splashing on the floor. I gotta get this latrine ready for inspection by 1300.
You have just heard X-1, presented by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine.
X-1, from the 19th of June, 1956, on NBC. That wraps up this hour of science fiction on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levoner. It's been a pleasure.